All right. Well, welcome to the February 2026 edition of the DMSC Masterclass. Happy New Year. This monthly program connects current DMSC students, faculty, and prospective students of the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. Our mission is really to bring to you face to face with inspiring masters in the PA profession. Healthcare leaders who have made transformative contributions to our field. So today we're really honored, and I've been looking forward to this, to host Dr. Sandra M. DePalma, a distinguished PA with an extraordinary career spanning clinical practice, leadership, research, and education. Dr. DePalma's journey exemplifies the evolving role of advanced practice providers in modern healthcare. She is currently the Vice President, Reimbursement and Professional Practice with the American Academy of Physician Assistants. But for our purposes, even more important, she is also a faculty member in our DMSC program. So, Sandra, welcome to the DMSC Master Class.
Thank you. I will say it's quite an honor to be here. I know that there have been a lot of inspirational and accomplished PAs that have joined you. So, very grateful to be here and discuss things with you today.
Well, Sandra, we'll jump right into it. You completed your BA at Mercyhurst University, your post-bac pre-medical certificate at Penn State, and your Master's of Health Science and PA Studies at Lock Haven University. So tell us a little bit about those days and really what inspired you to become a PA.
I did not take a direct route. My undergraduate degree was in dance, in ballet to be specific, but it offered me good scholarship opportunities to attend college. I really knew going into that I eventually wanted to do something to help people and something in healthcare. Really gravitated towards the PA profession. I liked that it was flexible, that it was collaborative, that it really focused on the patient and those aspects of medicine. And so it really just felt like a natural fit for what I wanted to accomplish and what I wanted to contribute.
Excellent. So, did you say dance and ballet?
Yes, I did.
So, are you still involved at all in dance and ballet?
I mean, I tend to be creative. I tend to exercise a lot. That's my avenue. I occasionally grab our dog Cooper and make him dance with me a little bit. Mike's a little less collaborative. I
Flexible
love
is the word.
it.
Flexible. I hear you. Sandra, tell us a little bit about, what did you hear about the PA program? What really prompted you to, say, I think I'd like to, move into this PA world?
I liked again that it was flexible, that you didn't have to commit to a single specialty. I never needed to do major surgery. I really was interested in working directly with patients. Helping them understand their disease states, how to prevent either initial or subsequent complications. And so it was really that patient-focused aspect and the flexibility of the profession that kind of resonated with me.
Well, after PA school, if I understand this correctly, you spent a lot of time in cardiovascular medicine. What drew you to that specialty, and what were some of the things that you really enjoyed while being in that specialty?
It was by chance. I wish I had something very prophetic to offer, but it was very serendipitous. It happened to be the job that I was offered coming out of PA school in my hometown. But in retrospect, I can't imagine having enjoyed a different field any more than I enjoyed cardiology. I mean, truth be told, it probably was like one of my worst subjects in school. I don't know how that disconnect happened or how I ended up in cardiology, but I loved it. I love that there's a lot of variety within it as a specialty. So it's not one note. Love that even 20 years ago and now we're still saying the same thing, that there's a lot of evolving technology and treatments. So it's not been stagnant by any means. A lot more things that we can do for patients to really treat them much better. I've always loved the evidence-based focus of cardiology. They've been very committed to that as a specialty. And then I think the other aspect, aside from the patient care, is that the cardiovascular field has been very inclusive and welcoming of PAs and APRNs, which some other specialties unfortunately haven't had that luck. And so they've really embraced PAs. We've been able to be members of their professional associations. We can now be fellows of the American College of Cardiology. So just a combination of what you can actually contribute as a PA, the benefits that you can provide patients, and then also just that inclusive, team-based, respectful environment that there is in cardiology.
Were you involved in any of the cardiovascular surgery or invasive surgery or mostly non-invasive in clinic practice?
Mostly non-invasive, but those lines have blurred so much in cardiology. Now there's interventional cardiologists doing TAVRs and ablations, and so not strict cardiothoracic surgery, but did work in vascular surgery and interventional cardiology. I'd say the majority of my time, though, was in electrophysiology. So that's all the electrical circuits of the heart, pacemakers, defibrillators. And then my true passion was prevention. So I ended up having advanced certification both as a hypertension clinician and a lipid specialist. And so that gave me an opportunity to really have patients referred to me from physicians and from other centers, and to contribute to the field of cardiology more than I probably would have ever thought I could, coming out of PA school anyway.
Well, and after that, you've pursued multiple advanced degrees, including a doctor of health sciences at here at AT Still University. Talk a little bit about how, first of all, why, and the second, what were these educational experiences? How did that shape your professional trajectory?
I'm a nerd by background, so I always like to learn and grow as a professional and as a person. So I'm always drawn towards advanced education, whether that be through programs or certification or doctoral programs. Also, I started to get more involved in healthcare leadership at health system level, and realized that, for lack of a better word, was competing for positions with nurses who had DNPs, and that was really going to start to hold me back if I wanted to advance further. And so I did go back and get my DHSC through AT Still University. There were no DMSC programs at the time, so I'll be dating myself. Very much appreciated that opportunity. I think the benefits of education are multiple. So it's the knowledge, it's the experience, but it's also in a world where there is that hierarchy, and especially in science, where the pinnacle of education is a doctoral degree. And so sometimes you need that credential or that designation for advancement. Certainly, I don't think it's necessary for to be a good clinician, but if you're looking to potentially do something else. And then the connections, the opportunities that it brings you. It certainly gave me the opportunity to meet Randy and work with the DMSC program. So that opens up things that you would have not been exposed to. So stay in school and get to finish your DMSC if you haven't already.
Well, as we were putting the DMSC program together, I was talking with Dr. Jeff Alexander, and who and Jeff said you got to get a hold of Sandra De Palma and get her involved in the program. And he spoke so highly of you about your work in the DHSC program. And talk a little bit about your experience with Jeff, if you would.
Sure. So he was my, we didn't have a capstone. We had a research project. I'm blanking on the exact term of it because it's been like
ARB or
ARB.
ARB.
Yes. Yes. Because it's been about 10 years and that was a blur. So I did mine on factors that affect provider satisfaction, looking at what are the things that actually improve satisfaction, reduce burnout, perhaps keep a practitioner employed and engaged in the practice. And so we did research and looked at that and found that it was primarily, yes, benefits, financial compensation, they contributed to that, but really the main factors were autonomous ability to practice to the top of your scope and license, the ability to be unburdened with regulations. So all those it altruistic, non-tangible things. And so we were able to have that published to really kind of contribute to PAs being able to practice without all those tethers that had traditionally been there, and to make the business case of that to healthcare systems. If you really want to have less turnover, increased utilization of your practitioners, reduce burnout, allow them to do what they're trained to do. So that was the gist of the study.
Well, you've been involved in multiple research trials, including the Cabana trial. Can you share with us some of your insights from, your research experience?
Sure. I had the opportunity to be a sub-investigator in both pharmaceutical trials and NIH trials, run very similar. There are PAs who actually do primary investigation, PIs, not even sub-PIs for research. So it's a great area for PAs to get into, especially if you're looking for something that's maybe a little different than straight clinical practice, or even a combination of clinical and research combined. I think the interesting thing about research too is it really puts some of these tangible concepts that we hear about in PA school and in doctoral programs, decision making, autonomous decision making of the patient, randomization and being blinded to studies. And you mentioned Cabana in particular. That's an interesting one because a lot of the previous trials up until maybe 10 years ago were essentially pill trials. And so you were randomized to a placebo or to a medication. Then, especially in cardiology, but in other specialties, neurology, when you're doing implants and devices like that, you're now randomizing pharmaceutical management to an invasive procedure. So that's what Cabana was. So you had to have a patient be comfortable with the fact that luck of a draw would decide whether they were going to be on a medication for the next few years or whether they were going to have a major invasive procedure. Certainly wasn't blinded to the patient, was not blinded to the practitioners. I mean, so you had to do your best to just make sure you treated all patients similar. They've kind of evolved a little bit. I don't know if you're familiar with the renal denervation trials. That's where they denervate the renal artery to treat blood pressure. So they got a little more sophisticated in that they figured they could do a sham trial or a sham procedure. And so a patient was randomized to either sham or real procedure. So they were randomized and blinded, but then you still were doing a femoral artery approach. You still were having them, invasive risks. So just different ethical considerations that are coming about now, compared to when it was this pretty straightforward placebo pharmaceutical.
Well, Son, you've held, significant leadership roles in the AAPA. This is sort of a generalized question. How do you view the evolving role of PAs in healthcare? That's a big question, I know, because there's so much going on. But we'd love to hear, your thoughts about, we know where we've been, and we sort of know where we are, but where are we going?
I mean, when you think that it's been 60 years, I think now as a profession, it feels like 50 years was just yesterday. And I think we're going to continue to evolve. It's already evolved over that time and even within the last 10 years. But looking forward, I think what I see at the national level looking out is that we're going to be more embracive of ourselves as a profession, and less as, and I'm not saying that we did this completely before, but less as an assistant to the physician and more of us as an autonomous contributor within healthcare teams. I think you're going to see a lot more of PAs doing research, getting involved in pharmaceutical industry, getting involved in leadership and advocacy, being, in all aspects of medicine to the same extent that other practitioners are. So I guess that would be my thought is I think we're going to continue to push that envelope. I think the other area I'm excited to see more of too, I had the opportunity to help write clinical guidelines. So the 2017 blood pressure guidelines and expert consensus documents for cholesterol management. And I think we're going to see more inclusion of PAs as the frontline users of these guidelines and really giving recommendations and guidance to other clinicians, and that's going to be to their colleagues as PAs and also to physicians. Development apps. AI is going to take over, not going to take over healthcare, but take over the way that healthcare is delivered. So I really see PAs being in the forefront of a lot of that activity in that direction.
Yeah, in looking at your CV, your publications and presentations over really have covered a wide range of topics, that, like you just mentioned, from hypertension to healthcare leadership. And even over the last couple of years, you've authored and co-authored some really important articles for the profession. You know, what drives you to your commitment to knowledge dissemination?
If I didn't already mention, I am a nerd, so that's probably the number one. Mike can attest to that. It's interesting. I got my advocacy start with the American College of Cardiology, and they regularly have this phrase or this motto that they rely on the shoulders of giants. And I actually jotted it down just because I wanted to share it. And it's that we are like dwarfs on the shoulders of giants so that we can see more than they and things at a greater distance, not by virtue of any sharpness of sight on our part or any physical distinction, but because we are carried high and raised up by their giant size. So I was kind of molded in that thought process, and I've just always thought, as much as I've been standing on the shoulders of giants, I've been benefited from that, I want to pay that forward. So whether that be education, whether it be research, whether it be mentoring, advocating for the profession, I just want to make it easier for the next person when they come along so that they can be a bigger giant than I am. And I'm not saying I'm a giant, but that you can advance the profession that way.
Wow, that's great. I love that quote. And as Mike might tell you, my newest book that just came out is entitled Standing on the Shoulders of Giants.
Oh, and I did
So
not know that.
interesting. So very well. Well, you know, and thank you for that. Talk a little bit about, you know, over the last even 10 years now, the profession has really been looking at expanding its role. You know, what used to be called OTP, now called PA practice modernization, I think. Tell us a little bit about where we are with that, and nationally, and certainly more importantly, with states.
So we do have probably some House of Delegate wonks on the call here. So they will recall that this went back to HOD. I think it was 2017, and it primarily OTP, Optimal Team Practice, primarily addressed what the ideal working relationship was between a PA and a physician, and essentially said that that should be determined at the practice level. That was, getting close to 10 years ago. Now we have title change, we have interstate licensure compact, we've started to incorporate direct pay for services for PAs. And so we needed something that was more broad than just OTP and came up with this practice modernization. And so it includes OTP as a core concept, but it also is more inclusive and can continue to grow as, the evolving needs of the healthcare profession grow. I can also tell you that I think it's more user-friendly for states. If you look at it, it's a pyramid structure so that you have your core elements, and then you progress up to your optimal to give a little bit of a roadmap that states can kind of conceptualize that you probably should have the majority of the core components in place before you start to go for those optimal items, or you're not going to be set up to be as effective at getting that change done. It's also interesting. I'm not sure how many people know that the federal government is actually incentivizing practice modernization for PAs in the Rural Health Transformation Program. They actually award more grant funding to states that have optimal and modernized PA practice than states that don't. And over the next 5 years, states can continue to get more money from the federal government if they advance their PA practice modernization. So that's a pretty strong endorsement, regardless of your political views, coming from HHS, recognizing that this is critical to healthcare in the US.
Very good. Well, and you brought this up a little bit. Talk to us a little bit and an update on the interstate agreement allowing PAs to practice across state lines, the PA Licensure Compact. Where's that going?
It's moving quickly. I think I just saw as of last week, it was 21 states have now passed legislation to be part of the PA Licensure Compact. Also think this is going to increase rapidly over the next year or two. This is also incentivized by that Rural Health Transformation Program. So states can get more money both for having optimal practice and then also for having the PA Licensure Compact. So we're kind of selling this as a twofold way for states to get more grant funding from the government. But the Interstate Licensure Compact, it is a privilege to practice model. And so a PA will not necessarily have automatic reciprocity to practice in all of the states if they are licensed in one, but they will have the privilege to request to practice without having to go through the usual method of getting a license. So it streamlines it, makes it much more efficient, makes maintenance of licensure easier, but you do have to apply for those other areas. But it's critical. Telehealth, you need to be licensed in the state where the patient is located. Lots of healthcare systems now have tri-state areas where they're seeing patients, across borders. We know our military spouses often get into trouble when they want to move along with their spouse and then they have to get relicensed in another state. And usually it can happen quickly that they need to get that licensure. So, very, very important. I'd say that the other thing is it's probably about a year or two out. The way that these work is that once you have a critical number of states that have adopted the legislation, which we're at, then you have to create a commission to operationalize it, basically to make it run, to have the software, to have the infrastructure for it to all function. And so that's been being done, and that's end of 2026. Possibly 2027 is when they hope it'll be completed.
Will this enhance the ability for PAs to participate in telehealth or telemedicine?
Yeah, it really will. Yes, but with a caveat. So you will be able to practice much easier if the state is participating in the compact and you have a license in one of them, because then you can get the privilege to practice in all the others. You do have to practice based on the laws of the state where the patient is located. So to some extent, you're still going to be limited in what you may or may not be able to do, how much you may or may not have to collaborate with a physician. And so that's even more so that AAPA is focusing on removing these practice barriers in all states so that you don't have to have a supervising physician in a state that you're never going to set foot in, or be restricted, just because it happens the patients in one state compared to another.
Well, Sandra, we so appreciate your love of advocacy, and I guess that what advice do you give to our DMSC students, our DMSC graduates, and regarding the importance of advocacy?
Importance cannot be understated. Or overstated. For every voice that's proactively engaging in advocacy for the PA profession, you can pretty much guarantee there's going to be an equally or louder voice on the opposition side. We're still a relatively small profession compared to physicians, compared to APRNs. So I just got off a call with Medicare, the chief medical officer, earlier today, where we were able to talk about PAs and how we contribute to Medicare beneficiaries. And he had just had a call the previous week with the nurse practitioner. So it's very important that we also had our voice there. So I'd say just, being able to speak for yourself, for the profession. I also think that advocacy takes many different modes, or it looks different for different people. So some people get involved in state advocacy. Some get involved in federal. There's people who are involved in their local advocacy or get involved in specialty advocacy. So I just would say, there's no right or wrong. It's just whatever, wherever you can contribute and where your passions lie. I also think just being a great PA. And I don't mean just, but a good practicing clinician where you show patients your value and you show, the medical staff the value of a PA. That's advocacy in and of itself. So that I'll get off my soapbox, but yeah, I'm obviously passionate about it.
And no, we really appreciate that. I got a call yesterday from a PA, a graduate from ATSU, been a PA for 16 years, and lives in Tucson, and said, you know, she goes, I'm trying to understand a little bit more about the new law in Arizona. Is there anybody I should contact? And I put my hand on my forehead and said, have you ever heard of the Arizona State Association of PAs? She goes, yeah, but I'm not a member. And I said, well, let me give you some advice. And and we all know that in every state that I've been in, there's been a small percentage of PAs in that state who are members of their state association. And these are now I'm on my soapbox, but these are folks who have dedicated their lives to making the PA profession better in their state, whether it's Arizona or Utah or Florida or anything like that. And I don't know what to do. We try in school to encourage them. But then they get out in practice, and for some reason we sort of lose them to that advocacy. Do you have any advice on how to bring them back into the fold, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think planting the seed, realizing that it may not come to fruition until later in their careers. And I get, you're an early career PA, you're trying to get comfortable with your competencies in clinical practice. Now you're trying to figure out how to use an EHR, how to use your AI, scribe. I mean, it can be overwhelming. And then there's families and other obligations. But hopefully, if you've planted the idea and if we can. I will also say that we're trying to do a better job at AAPA of sharing our advocacy activities and explaining what we're doing so that people realize how much work is going into it, and then also inspiring them that, these are ways that you can get involved. These are ways that you can do that. I think being a mentor and encouraging others, even just to take small steps, kind of reaching out that hand. I was voluntold, but that's how I originally got into advocacy. Michael Clark, you might know him. He saw something in me and dragged me to the front of the line, and I'm very grateful that he did that. So, and I will just say too, I have a little bit of a philosophy of you get like one or two complaints about something, and then you better either just accept it or do something about it. So that's kind of just always been my MO.
Oh, very good advice. Absolutely. And a few minutes, I'm going to open it up for questions, but I really would like to talk to you a little bit about work-life balance. I'd like to ask you something more personal. I know you're busy, and you've got an incredible demanding schedule from clinical work, education, consulting, leadership roles. Frankly, what do you do for fun and personal fulfillment? And how do you balance that and prevent burnout?
Well, first, not only because he's on the call, but I do have a wonderful husband who's very supportive, goes along with many of my crazy ideas. In fact, I've roped him into original research, like, hey, what do you think about this? So he's a great sport, and I'm so grateful. But nobody's immune to burnout. I mean, I've never met anybody that's immune, at least. I think having a job that you're passionate about that aligns with your values, your beliefs. I truly can say that I love my job. The fact that I actually get to advocate for PAs on a daily basis and get paid to do that reward of doing that buffers the stress of the job. I mean, there's certainly with this administration, there's all chaos has broken loose in the last year or two. But knowing that you're fighting the good fight, and we often say we're on the right side of history. So if you can find that in your clinical practice, if you can find that in your educational programs, whatever that might be for you, that helps. And then I think, realizing that you need to take time for yourself and you need to do things that fill you and make you de-stressed or rewarded or whatever that is for you. I mentioned earlier on the call, I like to go to fitness classes. I guard that time very protectively. I leave Mike with the dog and leave the house, and good luck to you. And then I will also admit, because Otherwise, the person in the other room will probably tattle on me. Love to travel, love concerts. And so the latest thing that we've been doing is vacationing with our favorite bands. So in the course of 8 months, we'll have been to three countries and vacationed with two of our favorite bands. And you could pretty much stick a knife in me, and I know that I have that coming up, and that can stave off burnout. So, but I would just say whatever it is for you, whatever brings you joy, assuming it's hopefully healthy.
Really? Well, and there's also always dance and ballet.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, I'm going to open it up for questions, and comments from the folks that are here, and see what they have to say. I don't think I see anything in the chat, but have a comment or a question, just unmute yourself. And I know we've got some folks here who are not shy, and as I say that, Kendra's, you're on.
Sorry, but I only had one question, and then Sandra, that was wonderful, by the way. It was brilliant. I really appreciate your words, and I'll share in just a moment. But I got to know what bands you're like. What are your like? I love that you're such a fan. I got to know what were the bands.
So the one is Blue October. And we saw them in Cabo, and we're going back to Portugal with them.
Wow.
We actually befriended the bass player. We now have his cell phone number, his home address.
Oh my gosh. That you're like a groupie. I love
We are
it.
complete groupies, yes. And then the other one has a very unfortunate name. We're going to Palm Springs in March. It's the Airborne Toxic event. But they're both like alternative rock bands that have violins in them. So
Oh,
they've
that's
got like these
amazing.
awesome electric violins. And I will stop there, or I will tell you about it for the rest of the evening.
No, it's just so great that you have that commonality with your husband, and you both enjoy that together. And I think it's a beautiful, beautiful expression of just your relationship and your love that you have for one another. I love that. That's so great. All right, let me just say, and I won't take a lot of time. Thank you so much for your comments. Thank you for your passion on advocacy. You are truly one of those PAs that have done it all or really has had such an impact in so many areas of the PA profession. So I just really appreciate all that you've done, but you're such a wealth of knowledge, especially when you just know, it's like you just know so much about everything, which is truly remarkable. And I just wanted to say, kudos to you. Kudos to you.
Well, thank you. And like I said, on the shoulders of giants.
Well, I'm just really proud of you, and you're exactly where you need to be. You are
Well,
such an asset to wherever you are, and you're really exactly where you need to be. And I will say this about advocacy. I don't know. I kind of was forced into that, not forced into advocacy unbeknownst to me. It's not like I altruistically went in, and even though I had a heart for patients with disabilities, I didn't really do much until I was kind of forced to, right? As a very busy clinical neurosurgery PA. And I think that it is very commendable for people like you that go into advocacy and don't really have to. In other words, I think my age group, the 60s, are ready to kind of get involved there. So I think that's the group that really can do it. It's the PAs that are the younger ones with young families. I get it. It's hard, but it's kind of like some of the PAs that get very comfortable even though their families are grown, right? And that's, I think, the call to say to those people, whether that's in your 50s or whatever, is don't get too comfortable. Let's, come help us. And so I just applaud you and thank you. But I think that there's a seasonal aspect to it as well.
Yeah, and well, first of all, thank you for everything that you said. I really very much appreciate that and acknowledge that. I think you're right, though. It is seasonal. You have to get people where they're at when it's right for them. And I think that sometimes people start to experience burnout at a point in their career. They're looking for something different, even if they're not burnt out. They're looking for that next challenge. And I try to remind them, even if it's volunteer, like you might think that's more work, but sometimes that work that you do has rewards that are trade-offs. You might be getting frustrated in your clinical practice, but if you speak up for a quality improvement committee, or you volunteer, at the national conf or the state conference that you are going to, you can do small incremental advocacy efforts. even though people think it's going to take time, they think it's going to take more resources and more out of them, they often find that that's bolstering, like, that it actually has
Right.
that reward.
Right. You'd hate to have to get to the point where we have to report to NCCPA that we did 10 hours of advocacy hours, and say where it's mandated. We'd like to think that we can just get out and do it. But anyway, I'll let others comment. But thank you for everything, Sandra. You're truly amazing.
Well,
And
thank you.
thank
And
you,
I like the
Randy.
mandated advocacy. Wouldn't that be nice if we could
I
do
know. I know. I'll mandate you.
that?
Thank you.
Thanks, Kendra. All right, other folks. I know you.
Sandra,
No,
it's Jim Ally.
there you go,
Yes,
Jim.
real quick. So thank you for your advocacy and your leadership and, in my case, mentorship from afar. I've watched you and just been enamored with what you've done. Unlike many of the other folks, including yourself, I wasn't kind of coddled into advocacy. I volunteered. And it's sort of like, watch what you volunteer for conversation. It's been wonderful, but it's challenging. And so on the family practice side, I just, we're having a hard time, like everybody else, getting PAs to kind of join our CO. Any thoughts about that from your perspective?
In full disclosure, so I don't work on the state advocacy team, and they're the experts in engagement and grassroots advocacy and all of those things. I'd say I do think there's some value in kind of micro advocacy, that if you can create small opportunities, whether it be for a shorter time or for a shorter investment of commitment, at least at the early stages, that people maybe would be less afraid to try their hand in advocacy if they have something very clear that they could do and know that it's not going to be a 10-year commitment. I'm exaggerating. But I have heard that sometimes that can be an opportunity, and or having a mentor, having somebody paired with them that, maybe they're a junior member of the conference committee or something like that, where maybe they don't have as much responsibility, but they can kind of get their feet wet and see that it's not scary and that they do have those competencies. I will also say that we're putting together, or we're planning to put together, some more advocacy CME kind of how-tos. I think people are afraid of advocacy, but I mean, explaining complex processes and rules in a layman's term, connecting with people on one-to-one, explaining, the history and the science behind why something is the way it is, engaging people that they're willing to consider changing. I mean, that's all the things that we do as a PA directly can be applied to advocacy. So kind of trying to show them too that it's not rocket science. You maybe need to do things a little bit different, but you already have those skills.
Okay, very helpful. I got some notes. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Sandra, I'm of the generation where you didn't have a choice about advocacy. It just was there. And I used to say that PAs didn't get involved in advocacy until the regulatory board was hovering over their house in a helicopter. And then they would say, maybe I should do something. And unfortunately, we've done so well, I think, over the years, and certainly back in the day with, prescribing, commissioning, legislation, enabling, all those things that we fought the battle for, and everybody's sort of fallen into a false sense of security, I think, sometimes. And I think that, wouldn't you agree, there's so many other things that we need help on.
Yeah, I mean, the really big barriers have been taken care of, I would say. I mean, people don't even realize that, until 20, 30 years ago, PAs weren't even reimbursed by Medicare in all settings at an equal amount. So, but yeah, now we've taken care of the big things. And because of that, the healthcare is more reliant on PAs. And then those little things come up and just or blister or like, thorns in the side, because they're still, so they're just different now. But yeah, thankfully you took care of all those really, really big ones. So thank you.
Oh gosh, yeah. I know Jim's aching to say something. I can tell
Oh,
by
not
his
aching,
face.
but I love the discussion about advocacy. And Randy, I totally agree. I'm a PA, graduated in 1975 in California. graduated before they even had any regulations that allowed us to practice. So, you had to do something in order to get regulations enacted. So it was, I think, it was part of the culture in those days because, and then those regulations, the PA regs, were so restricted. It was ridiculous to, it was almost impossible to practice. Back in the day, we actually had to have a patient sign a consent. So you can imagine we spent a lot of times. But I use the term, Sandra, that advocacy is, we have health insurance, auto insurance, life insurance. We've got all these things in life, but we also need employment insurance, and that's where I think advocacy is. And if PAs don't realize that, they're missing the boat completely. And Kendra, when you were talking about what can you do to be an advocate, going back to what Randy stated about how a member or somebody contacted him and he said, "Well, join your state society," it's writing a check. Sometimes it's just literally belonging to the organization, writing the check, empowering others to, that money's empowers them to lobby, to contribute to a legislature's campaign and that sort of thing. And that's how those relationships sort of happen. Some people are good at walking in and shaking hands and kissing babies, and some people just are great to write a check. But we all have our part, and I think we all need to be members of our state organizations and of our national organization because that empowers all of us to be good advocates. I'll tell you a little story. When you talked about OTP, it was interesting. I don't know, Jeff Katz, obviously. So Jeff was the chair of the, he had been appointed chair of the, I can't remember the commission, but it was a PA practice commission. And anyway, he was the one, they were the ones that came up with the pillars of OTP. And when they originally presented it, they presented it at Leadership Summit in 2016, and it was to a small group of past leaders. And oh my gosh, everybody was so upset because the nomenclature they were using was FPA, Full Practice Authority. And there was a huge pushback by a lot of the old leaders. Not, I mean old, not generation, not, but the ones who were very afraid of what physicians were going to think if we had full practice authority, because that's what the NPs were doing, seeking their independent practice in the states they've succeeded. And it was literally they wanted to emphasize that PAs were worked in teams, that we valued our relationship with physicians. And long story short, it came out sort of muted, but the original vision was to be full practice authority, which I really sort of still think it is. We're just sort of muting it a little bit still because and then you mentioned how the current administration is looking at rural health. And if we go back and look at the history, the Carter administration started recognizing nursing in rural practices and reimbursing them as 1099 employees back in the Carter administration. So hopefully we're looking at the same thing happening now. With this administration, making sure that we can get, some way we've got to get PAs embedded into rural communities, and some of those other ways we're going to have to do it is going to rest too about getting rid of, I think with Incident 2 building and things of that sort, which I think will contribute to that as well. Thanks so much for doing this. It's always great to hear your story, other stories. I appreciate all you do for all the PAs of the nation.
Oh,
And
well,
for what
thank
you
you.
do regard the students at AT Still.
Yeah. It's interesting some of the things that you said because Incident 2 is a bane of our existence. For those of you who don't know, it allows a claim for a PA provided service without any input on a physician for that claim to be submitted under the physician. And the thing that bothers me is that for every claim you take away from a PA, you're also then giving it to a physician. So you're creating and you're creating equations problems on both sides of the equation. So it makes it look like physicians are doing all this exponential more work compared to PAs. Started to talk to the Medicare Innovation Center. So they have the ability to do some things that are outside of the statute. So, some things are regulatory restrictions. We have purview within the agencies to work with them to try to get those barriers. In theory, that should be easier. It not always is. And then you have statute. 85% payment. Incident two is in statute, but we were starting to talk to Innovation Center. Could you do a different payment rate for PAs that are in primary care and rural settings? You could create a model and test it and see, and you could potentially even take away incident two and just let them have the higher payment rate. I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow. I'm just saying that we're trying to think of very creative ways that we can use some of these existing opportunities to improve the practice environment, improve transparency of services provided by PAs, get PAs into rural and underserved areas. So.
That's gonna help James and the FPCO do things, because there you go, James, you've got a crisis, so to speak. And one of the people, one of the things we used to always say in advocacy is it's always great to have a crisis. And if you don't have a crisis, work on developing one, and you'll get more members, and you'll get more community, you'll get more people involved. And not saying you go out and create the crisis, but it's things like Sandra's saying. Those are the things that you have to start looking at as a group on how can it benefit what your members deliver. And those are the kind of things that you got to get people excited.
Well
Sandra,
said.
so we're involved with we're doing some of these things already. We're working with Arizona, Minnesota, and New York through the AAFP. And so we've already put feelers out about the issues you're talking about, equal pay in rurals and getting more of the APPs, because they want both. So and I've sent out concept briefs to three different places, and they're at least not throwing it back at me,
Oh,
which is
that's
a good
great.
sign. So we've been working on this for almost a year now, since I went to the AFP that really kind of launched it, when I went back in October and met the chair, and she was very interested in what we had to say. So well, we could talk offline another time, but we're starting this, and I'm curious to see where it's going to go.
If other folks, other questions or comments?
I'll throw my two cents in it, and just for the sake of fluffing up Sandra a little bit more so. And I think, I was not involved in advocacy at all, and it was the coming home and complaining about things over and over again. And Sandra finally said, "I'm done hearing you complain. You need to go out and do something." And I did. I joined our state society. I ended up running for the board. I ended up being on HOD. And once you start to see things from the other side, you realize that the wheels of justice do turn, but very, very slowly. And to me, it's like volunteer fire company in a community. Everybody used to have volunteer firefighters. Everybody in the community knew how to fight fires. Once they started paying firefighters, nobody knows how to fight fires anymore. And to Sandra's credit and to her team's credit, advocacy tends to run smoothly enough that they handle all these fires that a majority of the PAs don't realize there are problems. It's not a problem until it's a problem, but it's not a problem until it's a problem that affects them. And they don't realize it's affecting them because all these problems are being addressed at another level. So, I think part of the whole getting people involved is for them to realize it's a problem. And I don't know that there's an easy solution to that, because until it directly affects their pocketbook, or until there's an easy solution to it, I don't think there can be. But I just wanted to say, I from a perception of being on the outside, being involved in it, and now kind of being removed from it, I can definitely see that what is being done from the advocacy standpoint, 189,000, how many of us are here? 980 PAs or 70 PAs don't realize how much is actually being done at that level. So.
And don't you think, both Michael and Sandra, that you have to find your niche? You have to find what it is that there's so many things out there, but there's something there. And I know Kendra knows this. She's so involved, in the whole idea of PAs training and caring for disabled patients. Finding that niche and finding what you love is really important. You can't do a little bit of everything, but you can do a whole lot of something, I think.
Yeah, I was very involved in cardiology. So I did not do the route of state advocacy. I got involved in the specialty organization. So similar to Jim, I got involved in the cardiology PA. And then luckily, American College of Cardiology had a PA work group that we could get involved in. So yeah, it can look different to different people. I also always thought of myself as a patient advocate. Like the main reason I was doing things was because I wanted patients to have access to the care that I knew I could provide and the care that I knew other PAs could provide. I will just as a quick side shout out, the one thing I really like about working at AAPA is the whole advocacy department has that as its focus. Really, when the why is asked, it is because it's good for patients. The secondary benefit is because it's good for PAs. But there's really that advocacy lens. And when we talk to Medicare, when we talk to payers, it's really not why do PAs want to do this or why would this be good for PAs? It's PAs are the answers to these problems that you're facing, and patients are going to be the ones that benefit. So it's a very rewarding being able to be on that side of the conversation.
Well said. Anybody else have a question or comment before we start winding this down? Nope. Okay. Well, Sandra, your journey it certainly is a testament to the impact of dedicated healthcare professionals who really combine their clinical expertise, their leadership, and research, and the commitment to continuous learning, to take that next step. So, thank you for all the great work that you do. Any last comments before I make some final comments myself?
Only other comment would be that I'm happy to be a resource and be a mentor to people. So anyone watching this now or later, please feel free to reach out, S. De Palma at ATSU, or sorry, Sandra De Palma at ATSU.edu or S. De Palma at AAPA.org.
Well, once again, I really want to express our heartfelt gratitude to Sandra for sharing her valuable time, her expertise, and her insights with us today. Her certainly remarkable journey serves certainly as an inspiration to all of us in the PA profession. And she really, exemplifies the incredible impact that we can achieve when we commit to excellence, service, and lifelong learning. So, thanks all of you for being here. Please mark your calendars for our next DMSC class, March 9th, 2026, at 7 p.m. Our guest is going to be Jason Moore, PhD, PA. Dr. Moore is a clinician, researcher, and a wilderness medicine educator with 30 years of experience in remote and austere environments. He holds a doctorate in epidemiology and public health. And his clinical background includes general and trauma surgery, emergency medicine, and critical care. And just as a side note, he's guided some of the best water in the United States, supported expeditions in Central America, Tibet, and China, and explored remote regions of South America, Africa, Australia, and isolated places in the Pacific and Indian Ocean. So if that sounds exciting for you, please join us on the 9th. Until then, I wish you continued success in your studies and your professional endeavors, and keep pushing those boundaries of what's possible in healthcare. So, thank you and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you,
Thank
everyone.
you, Sandra. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you, Sandra and Andy.